Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Let me introduce you to our panel. I'm joined this morning by Hugh O'Connell, political editor of the Sunday Times, Oisin Coughlan, chief executive of Friends of the Earth, Shona Murray, Europe correspondent for Euronews, and finally Stephen McNamara, chief executive of Paralympic Ireland. And a happy, almost nearly new year to each and every one of you. Hugh, I'm going to start with you. It was a year of extraordinary tumult in Irish politics, but in the end, little has changed. In what must be the most concise review of the year, less than 500 words, I don't know whether that's kudos to you or your sub-editor, you've managed to caption an enormous year in a very short piece of space in the paper.
Yeah, well, those interested can read a longer version online at the sundaytimes.ie. But
it's almost more effective for how concise it is when you look at the year that was.
Well, that's thanks to the excellent subs in the Sunday Times. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's been an extraordinary year. A lot has happened politically, but we are at a situation now heading into 2025 where the Taoiseach and Tánaiste will swap roles, Micheál Martin and Simon Harris, but they will be the leaders
and
of the government.
Take us through, just in case we need reminding of what were the sort of the highs and lows.
Well, I mean, the identity of the Taoiseach has changed. I mean, Leo Varadkar started 2024 as the Taoiseach, and then obviously by April he was gone. Already by that stage we'd had two disastrous referendums in March on the family and care, which were soundly defeated by the public. Harris, you know, elected, you know, assumed the top job unopposed. He had a couple of early successes in terms of, you know, shepherding through the state apology to the Stardust families, the state's formal recognition of Palestine. And then Fine Gael had a better than expected local elections. Fianna Fáil did okay as well. They kind of both held their own. Sinn Féin had a pretty disastrous local elections, 12% of the vote, even though they increased their number of councillors. But from the heady highs of 35% in the polls were the kind of crushing lows. And then in the Europeans, obviously, we saw kind of heavyweights like Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, or high profile names like Claire Daly and Mick Wallace losing their seats. Ciarán Mullooly, formerly of this parish, ascending to the European Parliament. Labour making a bit of a comeback. Eamon Ryan resigned after the local and European elections, though he said he had made that decision well in advance of that. Roderick O'Gorman became Green Party leader. And then in October, we were consumed not just by the budget, but by a series of scandals involving the internal affairs of Sinn Féin. The resignation of two TDs from the party. And then we had the election, and the election campaign was, you know, by common consensus, kind of dull, but there were was noticeable, as I think, for the collapse in the campaign.
When you look back
Gael.
To Hugh, the reasons why Leo Varadkar decided to leave off, a mix of personal and professional, but also saying, you know, that he wasn't the person to lead them. When you look where Fine Gael ended up, just in terms of seats and percentage points, was he right?
Yeah, I think it would have been a lot worse for Fine Gael had he not stepped down. I mean, I think they would have had a very bad local and European elections. I don't think they would have been in a situation where they lost it. I think they lost only 10 seats in the local elections. I don't think that would have been the case had he stayed in office. And I think it's quite likely, possibly even, you know, maybe likely, I don't know, but we'll never know, but that he would have been removed by a very, you know, bloody heave in the summer if Fine Gael had a bad local and European elections. And I think they would have had a bad local and European elections. So what dynamic that would have created, I don't know. So Simon Harris, like, he had a bad election campaign, but up until then he'd been doing, I think, a pretty good job, or at least the polls would indicate that the public were happy with his performance.
And looking at that, Oisin, you know, whatever about where the politicians ended up, where we as citizens ended up, you know, what do you think we were voting for? Because in the end, we voted on, like, we were an outlier globally, you know, where a lot of people voted for change to oust governments, and we said we'll have the same, thanks all the same.
Yeah, I mean, we are an outlier in terms of the outcome. We did, however, the percentage share of the vote of both the parties, and all three parties, but both the parties are going back into government, did also go down, albeit only marginally. So that's the same trend as has happened across all.
So what does that tell us about us?
Well, I think it's a mix of between, there was some, you know, anti-incumbency, but there was, I think, more a flight to safety. I mean, I think because our election came at the end of the year, I mean, people knew Trump was coming back into office. There was a certain concern about that these good times can't go on. And of course, it didn't help. Like, to some degree, I think think the opposition lost the election rather than the government won it. Sinn Féin bounced back from their summertime low, but they still lost 5 percentage points, like a fifth of their vote from 5 years ago. So I think it was as much about the opposition not providing a credible alternative. I think one of the biggest things was that once Micheál Martin ruled out going into government with Sinn Féin, given how low their vote was falling, there was no really obvious path to an alternative government on offer.
What do you think, Stephen?
I think when you look at it internationally, I think, and then you compare it with Ireland, I think it's really interesting to see how the electorate and what's important to them comes through within the election campaign. And I think actually, from an Irish point of view, I think we should take great pride in the fact that actually, I think we managed to keep it relatively respectful. We probably
didn't make a breakthrough.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think in other countries across Europe, and I think in America as well, it was the politics of division, I think, that was really happening. And I think actually probably what happened, I think, when Leo stood down as Taoiseach, is we saw some of that negativity that was in the government maybe fall away. The well-rehearsed and practiced and definitely strategic attacks, I think, on the government from the opposition were almost annihilated when he just stepped away. The campaign ran very differently. The same ammunition wasn't there for them to have maybe with Simon. I think Micheál Martin had a really good time as Taoiseach. I think the Irish people really respected his time there and will reflect back on it
positively. Well, the Sunday Times, Stephen, says 180 years after a devastating famine that cost 1 million lives and led to mass immigration, and a century after achieving national independence, Ireland is one of the wealthiest countries and one of the wealthiest corners of the world. This, the Sunday Times editorial said, is the key reason why the outgoing government was re-elected.
I think it is, but I think if you look at other countries as well, where they've been relatively stable economies, in some countries I suppose are not as strong as they once were. But I think the key thing coming forward is the politics of division, and I think in Ireland we stood away from that. I think that's really good, and I think that comes down also because Irish people still overly consume, from a European percentage, news. You know, we are news junkies. We listen and we trust our media, and I think that's really important. That's maintained. I think that's the basis of a stable government, stable country. And I think credit where credit is due to the electorate. I know the numbers were low in terms of who came out, but I think people were really invested actually in this.
And shown quite a different picture when you look across France, Germany, Georgia, Croatia. You know, the story across Europe was very, very different.
Hugely different. And if you look at the European Parliament elections, the extraordinary surge of the far right in Austria, France, Germany. And if you look at the numbers as well, the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, a lot of the supporters
backed by one Mr. Musk.
Exactly, Mr. Musk. But remember, some of the supporters, actually the majority of the supporters, were young people in the AfD as well, which is extremely worrying. And same with the likes of Rassemblement National in France, Jordan Bardella, the leader of that party, essentially leader, de facto leader in the European Parliament, you know, a young guy in his...
And Marine Le Pen has been very strategic about elevating him.
Because he talks about the fact that he comes from an immigrant Italian background. So he kind of, you know, brings along the idea that they're not a racist party per se, but obviously, you know, immigration is key policy of theirs, cutting immigration. In Austria, you have groups like the Austrian Freedom Party, which would be very anti-supporting Ukraine. So then Slovakia, Robert Fico, he's basically a sort of a mini Orban.
You've got huge concerns.
Meloni is probably the most
important politician in Europe
at the moment. She gets on really well with Trump. He's talked about how he likes her. She made a speech recently at the European Council talking about how we need to be embracing Trump, that there's no concerns around Trump. But at the same time, you have Germany going to elections on February 23rd. So they're going to be totally preoccupied with German elections, and then France in a particularly weak position. So things are really fragmented in Europe, and it is seen as Ireland being an outlier, even though, as you're right, Oisin, that the percentages went down for the centre parties.
Shona, just before, because I want to ask Oisin just about the fate of the Greens all across Europe, should we take the warnings about the far right more seriously? You know, or do you think Stephen is very comforted by the fact that it didn't break through? But looking across the rest of Europe, is it something that we do need to take more seriously, Shona?
100%. Because even, you know, if you look at Portugal, the elections there, the far right surge, but the year before, the socialists, the S&D, essentially the Labour Party, were key, because they've always been quite strong in Portugal. So within one election cycle, you had the far right in government. And it's the same with Austria and other parties. And I think we also have to look at the experience as well, because a lot of those parties, let's say, in Finland and, you know, I mean, Finland and Sweden, the sort of Scandi, the Baltic countries, that would be very comparable to Ireland in some ways in terms of how people vote, like liberal and so on. You know, they ended up going into power with the far right, or at least having them supporting them. And that's not worked out well for mainstream politicians. And, you know, in Belgium, they're sort of, well, they're still, once again, they went for an election in June. They still haven't formed a government yet. But, you know, so we have to make sure that if there is a surge with the far right, that there is a cordon sanitaire, that you don't let those policies infiltrate, because it doesn't work. And actually, mainstream parties, the more they try to move towards the right, this happened in the Netherlands, you know,
they get captured by it.
They are captured by it, but actually the electorate don't even give them any support. It doesn't actually give them widen their electoral base. It's happening in the UK with Reform as well.
Yeah, and obviously with all of the potential influence, again, of the money that could flow in there. Oisin, just on the Greens, obviously, you know, they all across Europe and including here in Ireland, they have suffered hugely. Is that part of the Green agenda being adopted by mainstream parties, or does it not bode well for the climate agenda?
I think it's a mix of factors. But just before we get on to the Greens specifically, I think there's a risk of our complacency creeping into our discussion of Ireland. I think some of the reason why Ireland has been immune from this, some of it is we're a small society and we do have a shared reality still and a shared media. Some of it is just because we're awash with money. I mean, because underlying that, the housing crisis is real for a lot of people in Ireland, particularly the younger generation under 40. And inequality is real. Before you get to social protection and social transfers, we have one of the most extreme divergences of earned income, a very, very strong market inequalities. It's the state intervenes to help, and that softens it out. And obviously before the budget or before the election, we had all of the government support. If that's threatened in any way, as it might well be by, you know, a lot of that's based on a corporate tax bondoogle by Ireland taking more than its fair share of corporate tax, let's say. If that's threatened by Trump, there's no security to our... There's no assumption
we can... Other countries have that stability as well. Finland is one of the most stable countries in the world. So is Sweden. You know, we'd like to be more like those Scandinavian countries when it comes to education, housing and how they arrange their societies. And they haven't been immune to it. Germany and France similarly.
Yeah, but we shouldn't... Oisin's right, we shouldn't be complacent about the far right, and we should also acknowledge that, okay, there hasn't been a huge electoral breakthrough, but more people are voting for far right candidates in this country than at any point in our history. I mean, I'm not sure the maths of this, but I mean, I understand from talking to people who've studied this a bit more closely that they're effectively one of the fastest growing political forces in the country right now, because their base has gone from effectively zero to, you know, people getting tens of thousands of votes in the European elections who are, you know, racist, basically. And so on that basis, I think that's something that's going to have to be tackled. And I mean, one of the other trends of this year, and I note in the piece today, is, you know, the escalation in attacks on politicians going about their business, canvassing, putting up posters, that, you know, threats to their lives.
And Stephen, I know one of the things...
This is a new phenomenon.
In your interview with Frederick O'Gorman, he says he's going to have to adjust his life to now not having a close protection officer, which he says he's been very grateful for, given the attacks he's come under on the street.
And just on that, Stephen, I know you spotted one of the items in the paper on this call for a super junior on immigration. Is that something you think that... obviously, there's lots of demands for super juniors on very different things. It's John Drennan's piece in the Mail on Sunday, but that notion of needing a sort of a dedicated look at immigration, is that something you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I don't think actually Ireland is being complacent. I think we probably are. We probably are a little bit maybe a couple of years away from experiencing just how deep the sentiment is in Europe. But it's on the way. And I think the super junior idea for immigration issues and maybe coming back into the Department of Justice, something I think is really interesting and something to tease out. I think that the importance of the issue, I don't think, is being overlooked at all in Ireland. I think anybody who goes onto any of the popular social media sites, some in particular, you know, you can go on there and before you know it, your algorithm will show you things that are happening around the country. So we know that there's pockets of issues all around the country. I think it's really interesting, some of the stuff coming through Hugh's piece with Roderick around, you know, the placement of people in the last hotel in the village and things like that. And that really cut through. But I think the really important thing, and Hugh touched on upon a moment ago as well, is the safety of politicians. You know, when we look at Anne Rabbitt, Minister for Disability, you know, took a case recently, case upheld, lost her seat. A really good Minister for Disability, but was in the junior position and probably couldn't get through more that she wanted to get through for disability. And I think actually one of the things that I liked about the election, and I think it was at times probably seen as a boring election that didn't have the, you know, the worry of the immigration and that these people are going to take your jobs and your wives. All of a sudden, actually, the issue became disability. And then the junior Minister for Disability loses her seat. So, yes, I think it's a good idea to see a super junior. I think it's really good that we focus in on immigration issues. I'd love to see, as the Social Democrats had campaigned for a full Minister of Disability. I think Ireland is ready for that. I think the election issue, I don't know if there's anywhere else around Europe where disability became one of the election talking points.
Yeah, but it was, almost by accident, though. I mean, it was in part because of that disastrous exchange that Simon Harris had with that worker in Kanturk. But it became an issue, certainly. And obviously, the Social Democrats calling for a full cabinet minister for disability.
Can I ask, was that slightly harder for Simon because of his background what he's done for the disability sector? Did it feel more personally harsh for him, do you think?
I think it did. I mean, I think the fact that he handled it so disastrously and he knew almost immediately that he had, and then the backlash came, and then millions and millions of people looking at the clip on social media, an issue that he kind of got into politics on, and suddenly he was badly exposed on it.
I appreciate that, though. I thought that, he is well known, he has substance and credibility on this issue.
I think
people appreciate, look, this was a really one of those moments which we all have where we, you know, are exhausted, tired, and of course, I'm not defending it in any way. It was terrible, and it was really heartfelt as well, and it was really hurtful to see that woman's, you know, reaction. And it was, her distress. Yeah. And it was out of bounds. But at the same time, it isn't normally characteristic of him on that issue.
No, it isn't.
And that is obviously just, I'm sure listeners will be aware, it was when he was speaking with Charlotte Fallon in Kanturk. And it just became, Oisin, just one of those unpredictable moments in a campaign on which, you know, because when you think of how late people, after 50% of people decide which candidate or party that they're going for, it is little things like that.
Which are a quarter of people who might know the precise number who said they were only deciding in the last few days. So I think that was in a campaign that didn't have very many standout moments. It became a standout moment. I wish I thought it was about disability as much as I'd like it to be, but I think it was more about the Taoiseach who lived by social media, dying by social media and running out of new energy after 6 months of running around the country. Because in the exit poll, disability didn't feature, was down at 1%. And I'd love to see...
I think it changed people's perception of Simon Harris. They thought he was a nice guy, well-meaning, you know, heart in the right place, all these kind of things. And that moment, for them, was almost the mask slipping.
Speaking of unpredictable campaigns, Seana Murray, the race for the arse is being dominated by women. Yes. There is a piece, I think it's in the Mail on Sunday, talk us through
you
it.
You could probably guess some of those who may make it to the race. I mean, it looks like it's being led by women, but Frances Fitzgerald and Ray McGuinness, who would probably have to fight it out for the Fine Gael nomination, which I think it'd be very difficult because they both have very similar backgrounds. They both have a strong reputation in Europe. Ray McGuinness obviously coming as EU commissioner, where she had a successful enough time there. She had a successful run as an MEP. And then Frances Fitzgerald, you know, former head of the Women's Council, and also she had a very credible time as an MEP when she pushed through an EU directive on violence against women. And that was really successful, and she gained a high profile there. And they're both very competent.
And also
people.
The tribunal saying that she had
been exonerated, vindicated. Exactly. And so was that. There's Roisin Shortall. And then there's an interesting piece, it's by John Renn, about Mary Lou MacDonald, which he says could be a potentially dignified exit for her if she were to leave
because
as head of Sinn Féin. But I don't know, is there a discussion within Sinn Féin that Mary Lou MacDonald needs to leave?
Obviously, Sinn Féin's attempts to secure the presidency have been disastrous heretofore. But look, I mean, Mary Lou MacDonald is very, very popular. She is an excellent campaigner. Do you think this is her time? Could it be?
Popularity is not what it was, though. I mean, if you look at some of the opinion polling in advance of the election, I mean, she was kind of trailing quite far behind Simon Harris and Micheál Martin, which is kind of extraordinary for an opposition leader. But there's no doubt, I mean, she had a great campaign, I think. She got her mojo back. She had a difficult 18 months personally, as we know, and obviously her party's support collapsed. But she, you know, they did well. Sinn Féin came out with 39 seats. So I think that But at the end of the day, she's fought two elections trying to be Taoiseach, and she's failed to secure that. And in any other party, there would be a very open debate about whether there's a need for a leadership change. There isn't that in Sinn Féin. She has the support of the party. She told me a couple of weeks ago that, like, no one has said to her within from within Sinn Féin, I would expect her to say this, but nonetheless, she is saying it, and she's quite clear on it, that no one has said that she needs to stand down. She's intent on leading the party into the next election. I think it's pretty unlikely she runs for the Oireachtas, but you can't rule
out. And also, part of the criticism about her was about the €300,000 housing, and then the call for the Minister for Defence or Minister for Justice to resign after the riots and so on. That's not what presidential elections are about. They're not normally about government policy.
No.
So it would be a very
Stephen
different discussion.
Stephen McNamara, I think that, you know, anyone who runs the presidency probably should get some sort of a medal or lifetime counselling. They're vicious. They're vicious campaigns.
They are vicious. And I think, actually, if we look at the piece and the people who are listed, so Mary Lou, Roisin Shortall, Frances Fitzgerald, Mairead McGuinness, and of course Bertie Ahern, and then the outside chance there of Fergus Finlay. And what you would look at when you look at it, because they're bloodbaths, they really are. They're probably the closest thing we have to an American presidential election.
And a bit like the traitors, we sort of secretly love
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely,
know?
Yeah, exactly. We love it. We love it. We love to see what's going to happen.
It's terrible, but we kind of love it.
It always happens. And that's the thing. And I think if you look at, I don't know, I would agree with you. I'm not sure if Mary Lou's going to go for it. I think this is a wish list today, really, and it would be fantastic. And I think when was the J.D. Vance said the greatest political comeback in American history was pulled off by Trump. You know, could we see the greatest political comeback
could
of Irish
ushing
history with Bertie?
Bertie Ahern.
Could we ushing?
I think people who find Bertie popular are voters and they're older, but I don't think he resonates with younger people. He won't get benefit from being the peace deal leader.
I don't think he'll run.
Whereas he would get all his financials would get reexamined.
I think he'll run.
I do think it's a question whether
Will that give Fianna Fáil pause?
Well, I think all political parties have to consider what's in it for them. They're going to spend a lot. If they're going to run a candidate, they're going to spend north of $500,000, I think, in terms of a campaign. And if you look at Fine Gael, for example, they've never had a successful presidential election campaign, but they've wasted an awful
lot of money.
Mairead
McGuinness
Mairead McGuinness maybe has to ask herself whether it is to her benefit or not to have the Fine Gael branding attached to her campaign. Would she be better off running as an independent? She has a track record that extends beyond Fine Gael.
It's a really, really interesting piece by John Drennan, who also speculates that
Mary McCallaghan could also run for Fianna Fáil.
Yeah, well, and that, and also saying that one Green source said Eamon Ryan could be our candidate. Another says poll-topping MEP Luke Ming Flanagan and well-known public figures such as Panty Bliss, Shane Ross and Conor Lennon, while Conor McGregor's chances have appeared to have diminished, according to John Drennan, after that guilty verdict in the civil sexual assault case taken by Nikita Hand. It's interesting, Oisin, isn't it, those potential outside contenders?
The celebrity candidates haven't done that well in the past. Like Eddie Roach ran for Labour previously. Like, again, they're not steeled for the bloodbath.
I don't think anyone's steeled for the bloodbath.
Well, the politicians, people like Frances Fitzgerald and Mairead McGuinness are, and indeed Bertie, obviously, or Mary Lou, are far more used to it, and Roisin Shortall. But you do wonder, given the fragmentation elsewhere and the volatility elsewhere, is this presidential election the one where a non-party candidate could come through if they get the right backing?
Is it Hugh O'Connell?
I think it's more possible than ever before, for sure, yeah. Because as I said, I mean, I think political parties have to think long and hard about the benefit of running candidates under their banner, because, I mean, you know, didn't do anything for the Labour Party when Michael D. Higgins got elected, and he's got a second term now, obviously, and he will serve that out. But Labour has been, you know, is still kind of battling back from its near annihilation in 2016. So
that was a Michael D. vote.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I think that I think it's more likely in this election that an independent candidate could come through. But again, it depends on the political dynamic at the time. It depends what's going on politically. It depends how angry people are at the government at the time or not, or whether they find a particular government candidate acceptable. I mean, I do think the Roisin Shortall one is interesting. I mean, she seems to... The Mail, I think, ran a poll recently which had her coming out on top. Now, I would have thought Catherine Murphy would be more likely than Roisin Shortall to run for the presidency, but that poll, I think, would give Roisin Shortall some pause for thought.
It's an early one. Oisin, you said Bertie Ahern doesn't resonate with younger voters, but obviously there can be a reluctance for the young to vote. They didn't in the general election. So how do we change that?
Oh, that's a $64,000 question. I think I do wonder whether the way the Dáil now shapes up as the fact that there will be what will be described as a right-wing government, but certainly a centre-right government without any mudguard from the social democratic left, so to speak, and a opposition that could be styled as centre-left, may provide a clearer choice over the next 5 years, and may, if the opposition, whether they do it together or separately, can present a credible alternative government. I think that, and if the next government doesn't solve the housing crisis, for example, I think there could be a more obvious reason for young people to vote in 2029 or 2030.
Yeah, Stephen.
I'd love to see Panty Bliss go for it. Mm. I think it'd be fantastic. I think it'd definitely add colour. I think would
style
it be
exactly
it's style panache. We'd have to get some freedom of information requests on the cost of the makeup and hair. But we're awash with money, and I think this is something we should definitely invest in. But would it be Rory? Would it be Panty? Yeah. Either way, I think it would add colour and style to the proceedings, and I think
well,
we'd all embrace that.
If Panty Bliss is listening, you need 20 Oireachtas members or 4 separate local authorities. That would be, if nothing else, a hugely entertaining campaign. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with you shortly. You're all very, very welcome back. With me are Hugh O'Connell, Oisín Cuchulainn, Seana Murray and Stephen McNamara. And I'm going to start with you, Oisín, because the lead for the Business Post is tech industry and state to clash on new data centre restrictions. It's really, really interesting because Eamon Ryan came out recently, the outgoing Environment Minister, saying that Ireland is a world leader in hosting data centres, but we don't have the capacity for connections just yet. There's actually quite a lot across the papers on this dilemma between economic growth not falling behind, but also our climate targets, which are looming very close.
Yeah, so there's two challenges with data centres that the Business Post captures, and then there's some opportunity that the Sunday Times captures. Basically, the research from Paul Dean in UCC and Hannah Daly in UCC, which is mentioned in the Business Post, is that they're demanding so much of electricity, our renewables growth isn't keeping up with them. So basically, the entire renewables growth since 2015 is outstripped by how much electricity demand has grown because of data centres. So it's very hard to meet our climate targets.
Takes up a significant part of the grid.
It's 20% now. We're on track to 30%. Anywhere else in Europe, the average is 3%. So we're heading towards 10 times the European average. The only place that rivals us is Virginia outside Washington in the US. So that's a real challenge. It's very hard to see how we phase out fossil fuels because Paul Dean in the Business Post says on current trajectory we'd be spending 190 million euro extra on natural gas, on fossil gas, to power those data centres if we keep going as we are. And the other challenge is our grid just can't take it. So this is why, you know, I think Eamon Ryan's point is that in the 2030s sometime, if all the offshore wind comes online, then maybe we could power all these data centres by renewable electricity. But at the moment, the grid just, the renewables aren't there and the grid just can't take it around Dublin in particular. So there's a moratorium from EirGrid around Dublin, and the Commission on the Regulation of Utilities is coming out with new rules,
sure,
again, to secure the grid and to secure the climate targets. And they may say, for example, Paul Dean says they should say that every hour of every day the data centres must run on renewables, not just on average, they don't push out.
It is a dilemma because on the one hand it's taken up too much of the grid, but on the other hand you've, you know, these businesses, and especially in the context of Donald Trump having a second term as US president, this fear that we are going to be left behind, that we're going to miss out on some of those big investment decisions.
Yeah, and I mean you can see in that Business Post piece Mike Beery, the former head of Amazon Web Services, was one of the big cloud computing companies, you know, warning that these delays are going to mean that we miss the next phase of investment in all of this, and that obviously has knock-on implications economically. So it's a big challenge. I mean, that's an astonishing statistic that Oisín recited there, that, you know, we're heading towards 30% and the EU average is 3%. I mean, that I wasn't aware of that, but that shows you that you know, the reliance and the expectations that have been placed on Ireland from these companies. So it's a really tricky challenge facing the next governments. And it's interesting as well that what Eamon Ryan is saying is that this is not ideological, because it is perceived that the Greens are kind of ideologically opposed to data centres, but it's actually that, like, you know,
Look, I mean, when you look at across, you know, the European Union, you know, other countries such as Germany have flexibility in terms of using nuclear, you know, and moving in that direction. But I suppose it is that, because we, you know, even though we're a tiny country, our emissions and what we, you know, our carbon footprint per individual is still much higher than in other places.
Yeah, and actually that piece is very interesting because it talks about our competitor jurisdictions embracing the dual strategy of digitalization while also decarbonizing. decarbonising, which is something we haven't been managed to do. But we will lose out when other countries are embracing it. And then Ireland is just seen as a country that says no the whole time. So that is a huge
conundrum. We've said nothing but yes so
far.
So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, you're right. I just mean, I'm just looking at the context of the article that, you know, it's going to be, it's seen that, that Ireland will be left behind if we do put up a wall, or if we don't manage to do the two at the same time, embracing dual strategy.
Yeah, and look, I mean, Stephen, look, it's part of that big broader infrastructure story, but it, especially with the Greens now all but eliminated in the Dáil for the next session, do you think that the green agenda will be deprioritised? One of Roger O'Gorman's kind of complaints was like, oh, you know, that voice won't be there. But do you think that the green agenda will slip?
Slip? I don't think so. I think obviously if they're not there, they're not going to have the voice that they once had. But I think all parties are awake to it now. I just think it's that balancing act, isn't it? And like, running a country is not easy. You know, a lot of people, even over Christmas, people were saying, you know, get Michael O'Leary to run the country. You can't run the country the way you'd run a business. It's just that simple. And there are really difficult trade-offs. I mean, like the passenger cap at Dublin Airport is another thing that's going to dominate, I think, in the next.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, do you know what? The record of the Greens in relation to the last Dáil term, I think, has been relatively good. I think, you know, there's certainly some things that they've gotten through.
But it is that
trade-off in Ireland around green agenda. And I think sometimes still in Ireland, in some areas in particular, some people kind of glaze over. It's kind of like, well, I still want to cut my turf. I still want to burn fossil fuels. I still want to run my car. Electric cars are too expensive. So there's a lot of these things are in the way. But like, I think we all know we have to head in that direction.
Oisín Coughlan, the Sunday Times, I think it's in the business section, has a brilliant two-page thread on the Irish companies that are doing phenomenally well on the back of this.
This is interesting. This is the Irish companies that have made billions from the data centre boom here so far. But now, even before...
Because they're servicing the boom.
Yes, so they're producing electrical parts and ventilation and sort of planning around data centres. But what's interesting is even before any sort of sense of any moratorium in Ireland, they've begun to export those skills and actually export employees, and their companies are beginning to be taken over by big international players. So it seems that even if there was no more data centres built in Ireland for the next 5 years, those companies would continue to make lots of money, and those Irish people in them would continue to go and work elsewhere in the data centres.
Yeah, and it will be important, Seanan, just in terms of even, and obviously the EU had a massive competitiveness report earlier this year, but in terms of that innovation and that kind of being the leaders in green energy, where is the new Green Deal after this?
Well, it looks like because of the changes in the European Parliament, which has moved very much to the right, the green agenda is low on, you know, priorities for a lot of those people, but a lot of those MEPs would obstruct it. And if you look at the EPP, which is the champion of the Green Deal, led by Ursula von der Leyen, who genuinely does believe in the green agenda, but also has to deal with the farmers and so on, they've watered down the Green Deal when it comes to their nature restoration law, which only passed in the Parliament because the Fine Gael MEPs, who are in the EPP, which is the European People's Party, the sort of centre-right, they actually voted in favour of it. And other elements, the deforestation piece of the green agenda has been delayed for a year. So you do have a lot of these sort of basically climate sceptics in the Parliament that will slow down or delay legislation as it's passed. And of course, the Greens themselves have sort of reduced, they lost a lot of seats. But the other, I suppose, the only optimistic piece is that the socialist groups like the Labour and so on, it's quite mainstream for them to support the green agenda. So with the loss of the Greens, it won't impact too much. But I have to say, the green agenda is being seen as something that is, it's described as green ideology. So it's become one of those sort of culture war issues rather than something about saving the planet.
Certainly become a culture war issue.
Certainly in the US it has. Less so in Ireland, but certainly risk is there for sure. I mean, I think the Business Post actually has an editorial about climate where it has both optimistic and pessimistic takes. On the pessimistic side, there's definitely a change in the mood, it says. Although I think that mood is as much among politicians as among the public. The exit poll was interesting, where it said 51% of those polled said that they thought the outgoing government hadn't gone far enough on climate, including 47% of Fine Gael voters and 44% of Fine Gael voters, compared to like 15% saying too far. So for every one Fine Gael or Fine Gael voter that said the government had gone too far in climate, three were saying they hadn't gone far enough. That's not how Simon Harris and Micheál Martin have been behaving. I think they felt the edge for them was, a bit like in the EU, they didn't want to be outflanked by the rural independents, so they were appealing to that base. But actually their voters want to see more action. So I think it'll be dependent. Now that the election's over, the same, I have that question for you in the European Union. Now that the election's over, the EPP did a very much anti-green electoral strategy. Will they will they revert to the centre for actually governing now, or will they still, it looks like they're still looking for places to...
I think they're still, I mean, if you look at Manfred Weber, who's a leader of the EPP, he's actually moving much more to the right, and particularly on this green issue. So I don't think he's a believer at all. It's Ursula von der Leyen is, but also, as you talked about earlier, the Mario Draghi report talked about how there needs to be 800 billion euros of investment a year into the European Union when it comes to innovation, because we're falling way behind China and the US.
Speaking of investment and the potential risks that we'll miss out on it, Hugh O'Connell, let's talk about a Trump presidency and lots of dire warnings, and including Simon Harris writing a piece yesterday in the Irish Times outlining that we need a totally new diplomatic strategy, as he says again.
I think the main takeaway from the kind of Trump administration, or the incoming Trump administration, is that there is going to be a high degree of volatility and unpredictability. But at its core, Donald Trump wants to make a deal. He wants to make a deal on everything. He wants to make a deal to end the war in Ukraine. He wants to make a deal to end the conflict in the Middle East. Like, he wants to cut deals that make him look good. And so I think what Simon Harris was articulating yesterday...
He's gotten a very interesting dispute between the MAGA supporters and others over the H-1B visas. But he can be pragmatic, and including, I think he's...
But that's the thing, is that he can be pragmatic when there's a deal to be got and it's going to make him look good. And so I think what Simon Harris was trying to articulate in his piece yesterday was that we're now moving from kind of a values-based relationship with the United States to a more transactional one. And so that diplomatic offensive has to be built around that. And it has to be built around the idea of, you know, stressing to, and Conal Thomas writes about this in the Business Post today, about the known unknowns, but about stressing to the United States administration, Ireland is a huge investor in the United States. It's creating, I think, anywhere between 100,000 jobs.
Over 100,000 jobs.
Across 50 states. I think, according to Conal Thomas today, they're mapping out where what states these jobs are in. So it'd be interesting to find that out. Like, are they red states? Are they blue states? What, you know, are they the states that are kind of marginal swing states?
And Stephen, we may be down the list when you look at what Mexico and Canada, they're much, much more alive just presently to that. But the incoming Trump presidency, how much do we need to be worried about it, do you think?
I think we need to be concerned about it. You know, I think what we've learned from Trump is, you know, and I think it's covered by in one of the pieces today, that Simon Harris didn't get off to the best start, maybe when he referred to him as a ghoul. But like, the way back is to throw yourself at his feet and plead forgiveness and compliment him. And I think the one thing I think that Ireland does, and it always comes up every March, you know, should we go to the White House? Something's happening in the world. Should we go? Of course we should go. Of course we should continue to go.
It's a huge international trade mission.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it'll be Micheál's first trip to the White House. So it'll
start the last.
It'll be historic. Will he make it? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, the shamrock will have to be put on into the fridge just in case it gets delayed. But no, I think we need to be worried. I think we're in a good position. I think the Irish in America do punch above our weight, and I think we need to ensure that we continue to do that. I think the Trump presidency is something that can bring benefits for Ireland if it's played correctly, as long as we don't get lost in, you know, in
but it draws everybody into that transactional type of politics.
Just one thing on that is the undocumented Irish, of whom there are many hundreds,
potentially
of thousands.
Guesstimates, but when we, you're right, Oisin, when we speak about migration in this country, but there are many undocumented who could, if Donald Trump, you know, takes very, very tough measures, could.
But he hasn't been very nuanced about his plans, and
it's pretty clear that these are going to be extremely tough measures that are going to have very little empathy with families. Yeah. If you saw the child separation of the border policy was just one of the most horrendous policies ever. I mean, you look at those children being separated from their parents. There was a report about one child, a breastfeeding child, separated from her mother. And in those detention centres, 7 children died. How badly were these children treated? I remember the Director of Homeland Security arguing in the Senate that they didn't even have an obligation to give these children toothbrushes. I mean, these are incarcerating little children who have done nothing wrong from their families. I mean, that is... It's to me, I don't know how anyone could vote for Trump after having a policy like that. And this time it's going to be even harsher because there's so much, there's like almost bloodthirstiness coming from the Republicans or the MAGAs around this. You saw it at the RNC holding up signs, deport illegals, deport people. J.D. Vance's wife is a child of immigrants, and he was asked, do you want to deport children of immigrants? He said, yes, that's his own wife. It's really disturbing what's going to happen there.
But I think it'll be interesting if he does go through with it or seeks to go through, and he's putting in place far more loyalists who are far more committed to his agenda. Even sometimes
it's not his agenda, it's the Project 2025 agenda. It's harder.
If they actually go ahead with that, it won't just be the suffering of the people that as Sean has described. It won't be good for the US economy because like he may be caught between his MAGA base and his billionaire backers who actually don't want a halt to immigration.
He's very, very much caught with them because
I'm sure Amazon needs lots of migrant workers and so many other corporations do too. So I think it'll be interesting to see how he squares that circle, I mean, between cruelty and capitalism.
Can I bring you in, Sean, just on obviously huge issue this year, the ongoing war in Gaza and the extent to which Ireland may find itself caught up on the broader diplomatic front, both in respect of Europe and the US.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, Ireland is a bit of an outlier along with Spain and Slovenia for taking the position to obviously formally recognise Palestine. What I would say is nobody in Europe believes that this is motivated by anti-Semitism, but actually a recognition of Ireland's history being directly linked in some ways to the British Mandate of Palestine and then also oppression, colonisation and so on. You know, because I know that that's a slur that sometimes has been directed against Ireland. And the Taoiseach, because I remember asking about this in Brussels a few weeks ago, and he was saying, look, you know, Americans and investors know Ireland's position when it comes to Palestine. But at the same time, the Israelis are coming after Ireland in a particularly strong way. And we know that the Israeli lobby is very strong in the United States. Trump is very close to the Kushners. We know that he is extremely hawkish when it comes to Israel, but I mean probably comparable really to Joe Biden and so on as well.
And everybody knows, Hugh Connell, our position, but you know, the Taoiseach is saying that the Occupied Territories Bill could pass early next year, but it has been raised by the US Chamber of Commerce. It does, it could be a challenge for Ireland politically. The dynamics are changing.
Yeah, they are, and I think that in government they're taking very seriously the issues that this creates with Washington passing this legislation, even if it's in very limited format. You know, the intention is to press ahead with it, but I think there'll be kind of further legal advice taken. Don't forget, we're going to have a new Attorney General. Don't know who that's going to be.
You must know.
Well, I'm taking a little break over Christmas. In that environment, I think, you know, they'll be taking another look at this. And I don't think it's a case of, well, we committed to this in our manifestos and we're going to do it in the first year of government, as the Taoiseach said before Christmas, because I think there's a realization that if we press ahead with this, we will, you know, as Shona says, we'll add to that perception of being an outlier coming off the back of the very public decision by Israel to close its embassy here, the backlash, the influence that Israel
has in
Washington.
Even though Benjamin Netanyahu had actually
pushed for us to open in the 90s.
I just think it's a big issue, I think, for the incoming government, because the opposition will be on them like a hawk to get this done very quickly.
I think it's just worth reminding ourselves what's happening on the ground, because I think that is beginning to get slightly lost in the news agenda, not just because it's Christmas, but more generally. In the Independent on page 17, Wafa Shurfa and Sam Mendick have an article called "Israeli Troops Storm Gaza Hospital and Detain Its Director." The last remaining hospital in northern Gaza that was functioning on Friday, after overnight strikes that killed 9 people, including children, they stormed it, they set it on fire, they detained the director and the staff, they forced the patients and the staff out into the open to strip because they were searching for Hamas militants. This is the last remaining hospital in northern Gaza, and this is now happening. Like the strikes, there was 5 journalists killed during the week by Israeli
targeted strikes. I mean, in the last few days, babies have died of hypothermia because it's so cold there. They're living in damp tents. Children are having their arms and legs amputated with no anaesthetic on filthy floors. Children have lost their parents. They're orphans. Doctors are being targeted. We've seen reports of people being raped. The atrocities in Gaza are just so incredible. I think it's a really important point, Oisin, because we're talking about the political implications, when in actual fact, Ireland is trying to do the right thing by what has been widely described and been investigated as a genocide. genocide. You know, Netanyahu is wanted by the ICC for extermination and starvation. That's who we're what we're talking about.
And Shona, some of that has been brought home quite literally. I think there was another piece in the Sunday Independent where the clinical director of Children's Health Ireland is talking about the children of Gaza who have been evacuated.
Yeah, there was 8 in Ireland, amputees, children with ADHD, various illnesses, PTSD, trauma, and some of them with their families. I'm sure some of these children are orphans as well. So there's a child killed every hour in Gaza. We're talking about women having, by the way, C-sections with no anaesthetic. It is just apocalyptic. And I think what is really interesting as well is that rightfully the EU and Europe is defending Ukraine and the rules-based system in relation to what Russia is doing, targeting and another genocidal war in Ukraine. But at the same time, you know, the US is saying we don't recognise the International Court of Justice's investigation into genocide. We're calling the ICC anti-Semitic. So which is it? The double standards are really very dangerous when you're talking to other countries in the global south and so on. Say, oh, the West wants to defend Western values, but when it comes to Israel, we're not going
to do
that.
They point out the challenges, Stephen. This was already the highest level of armed conflict that the world was experiencing even before the Ukraine conflict began. And now with Gaza, it's a very, it sometimes feels like it's a very dark moment.
It does, and it's hard to read, you know, and I think sometimes, and I applaud the fact that we actually read out the headlines today, because it does get lost. And I think, it, you know, it's fallen into that category of, you know, it's very risky when you become a monster trying to defeat a monster. And I think what we've seen in recent months, particularly again, if you go onto social media, is a hugely targeted and concerted effort on the communications basis and on a propaganda basis, really, to try and influence in relation to it. And I think the closure of the Israeli embassy here, I think, was as much part of that, actually, to try and win a narrative. But again, you go onto social media and you see people from across the world saying, are they really trying to take on Ireland, who are globally loved, who are seen as, you know, the peacemakers, to close an embassy and make it out that we are in any way anti-Semitic. I think it is really important that we do recognise that what happened in October of last year is disgusting and tragic, and we can't lose sight of that. But it is that ability, I think, in Ireland in particular, I think we have it enshrined in the way we think, is that not every criticism means that you are completely against the person.
It's strongly defended, making sure the hostages are released without conditions, and that's the right thing to do as well.
And on that, Shona, I'm just going to have to take a very, very quick break. We'll be back with you shortly. You're all very, very welcome back. Hugh O'Connell, Oisin Coughlan, Shona Murray and Stephen McNamara with me. Stephen, France might be in a terrible state of chassis politics wise, but my goodness, didn't it deliver this year, the Olympics, the Paralympics?
Absolutely, yeah, incredible year. And there's a lot in the papers actually today looking back and looking forward on the year that was. Really nice mention by Eamon Sweeney of a clear star that's come out for us, Roisin Éireann from Limerick, who won Young Sports Person of the Year here in RT Sports Awards a few weeks ago as well. Just take my hat off to the organising committee of it. You know, the Parisians really pulled it off.
After all of the complaining beforehand, and they really got stuck in.
Yeah. And apart from it lashing raining for the opening ceremony of the Olympics, I think it really, the sun shone in France, and the French people actually brought a huge energy and enthusiasm to it. I think as a nation, everybody got in behind the teams. It was wonderful to see our Olympians bring back a record number of medals. Wonderful to see our Paralympians
And also,
bring
I think
back
the proximity that so many Irish fans, including myself, were able to travel over and support the teams.
Absolutely. And that's really what we went for strategically. We knew that this was, we're not going to have a home games again for a long time. The next one's going to be in America under Trump. Yeah. So we'll have to do some cozying up there. But it felt like you could get there. And you know, we had people who had travelled over on day trips and came back again. You know, they enjoyed it so much. The stadiums were full. The Paralympics, actually, the first few days in the swimming pool were oversold, even ahead of the Olympic Games. And I think it was a really strong performance from Europe, from France and from Ireland. And I think congratulations to all the athletes.
Yeah, it was amazing. Shona, quickly, did Time magazine, staying with France, did they miss a really, really big trick by not placing Giselle
Pellico? Yeah, on exactly. Its cover? I know the bravery of that woman who was desperately raped over 10 years by around 51 men.
No,
her husband.
That they know of.
that we know of, exactly, yeah, who have been found guilty. Her husband drugged her, gaslit her, because the woman was having these, obviously she was traumatised because she felt like she was just, you know, had narcolepsy or something because she was falling asleep.
He was bringing her to hospital appointments
to see what was her. And then she also got sexually transmitted diseases from these men, and he accused her of cheating. Yeah. She thought she had a perfect marriage. She thought she had a husband who was making her dinner every night, but actually he was crushing tablets into her food. But anyway,
she decided
that she was going to make this trial public. And just the array of men who were involved, journalists, doctors, lawyers, a judge, teachers, the whole wide gamut of French society. And she is definitely a brave woman. She could have been, and I also think, by the way, besides Trump, I would not have put Trump on the front page of Time. I don't care.
I think Zelensky should have been there.
Look at what Zelensky is doing right now. Now he has to deal with the Trump presidency. He could see Ukraine fall because Trump decides he doesn't want to give support for Ukraine anymore. Trump is saying that he wants NATO members to give 5% GDP for defence, which most countries will not deliver on. So we're in a very, very serious existential crisis when it comes to Europe. And Zelensky basically is holding it all on his shoulders. So those two people, I think, should have been on Time magazine.
I think the shame must switch sides, I think, has been probably one of the big hashtags of the year. Hugh, looking ahead to the new year, are you a New Year's resolutions kind of a guy?
Not really, no.
Luke O'Neill is. He's talking about...
Perfect, though, Hugh, aren't you?
Yeah. Thank you, Shona. Luke O'Neill has an interesting piece just about the kind of science behind New Year's resolutions. And one of the interesting things he notes is it takes, I think, between 18 and 25 days for a new habit to kind of
fully
embed
formed.
Itself. So if you are planning any New Year's resolutions, stick with them. Don't give up
Stephen,
after
are you
a week.
I always wait to Nulag Nama on the 6th. It'd be rude to start anything before then. Or
So I am. And actually, I've gotten out ahead of the game on this one. One of my resolutions, and one of the things I've always really wanted to do, is get a little bit better at Irish. So I'm on, I mentioned it, Duolingo.
Yes, I'm sure there's
other apps as well that you can use for that. But I'm on that. And I think everybody, actually, get on to Duolingo, have a look, improve your Irish, and let's start using it a bit more conversationally. I'm terrible at it, so I want to get better.
I tend to wait until February, never mind, to Bridget Stain, never mind, because January is
too
a write-off.
Yeah. What about you, Sean? Are you looking forward ahead to New Year's resolutions kind of a gal?
No, but I think I used to hate January, but now I'm trying to embrace it as a sort of, you know, time for change. But I haven't come up with any resolutions yet. I mean, there's loads, you know, to be like, could be there forever, but eat healthier,
second
I guess.
Hour.
Absolutely. Well, I love now is that it's Nulag Na Mon, it's Bridget's Day, it's International Women's Day. We're sort of ticking over.
Don't say that. Jesus, you'll have the incels after us.
Well, hopefully that will not be the case. But listen, it's been absolutely wonderful having you all join us this morning for all the chats. Hugh O'Connell, political editor of the Sunday Times, to Oisin Coughlan, chief executive of Friends of the Earth, Shona Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews, and finally Stephen McNamara, chief executive of Paralympics Ireland, and we'll bring you back next year to see how the Irish is doing. But for now, thank you very much for joining us all. We're going to cross over now to the newsroom and to Aidan Fitzsimons.